This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This is the Bite Me Podcast. Don Lopez and Captain Scott Null. Big weekend of fishing behind us. Big weekend of fishing in front of us. And also big weekend of storms. And we got a lot to cover with you on the Bite Me Texas Saltwater Fishing Podcast. As always, shout out to everybody sending questions to us our way. We love it. We'll try to talk about it all we can, tell you what we know, and use it however you want, man. A lot of people have been using our information on the Bite Me Saltwater Podcast and catching some big fish. I had a good weekend. I had a really good weekend. Got a lot of stuff done on the boat. New battery charger, new Talon, new plug for my Talon. And then I decided, I think I'm just going to go ahead and go fishing. I ended up catching a big old monster trout. That was a lot of fun. I know that was Saturday. Sunday got interesting, to say the least. All up and down the Texas coast, that storm hit, and it hit with fury. It was green, man. You and I were talking about before we turned this thing on and started recording. It was green. But here's what we got going on the Bite Me Podcast today. First of all, we like to call it the best in Texas inshore and offshore insight, that the next best thing to being on the water is the Bite Me Podcast. You can subscribe today and be a better fisherman tomorrow. And we say that because of you. I mean, we have so many listeners that really plugged in and really help us out with questions and topics. And then we tell you what we know and we go from there. Today on the podcast, what happens if you do get stuck out in a hellacious storm like Sunday? This is topical, obviously. You know some people that went out in that stuff, Captain Scott, and I saw a couple of boats. So what do you do? What do you do when you get stuck in that situation with a really bad storm on the water, waves and whatnot? This came from a listener as well, actually from a friend of mine whose GPS went out while he was on the water, and he said he felt naked. Old school techniques that still work, trying to find fish and navigate, but mostly from a fishing perspective, what you do if you don't have, where you can record your tracks, etc. A lot of guys give up, like this dude said he felt like coming in. Nah, man, there's ways to go in case if your GPS goes out, if you don't, just go old school. Another question. Dude was just missing too many fish. What's your batting average on hookups? If you're missing too many, and we will dig deep into this. What is it? Is it equipment? Is it user error? Is it a combination? What is it? We're going to also talk about polling skiffs from last week's podcast. We didn't get all the way into sight casting, polling skiffs, and we got the best expert when it comes to that sitting right across from me and Captain Scott Null. So we're going to dig in a little deeper to that. To swivel or not to swivel, talking about tying your lures or and such on your line. How do you do it? What's the best way? And I like this topic as well. Hopefully we'll get to it today. If not, we'll get to it next week. Trout have really keen senses of smell and vision. We've discussed that, and we'll dig in a little more. Does adding scents to baits help? And are there things we should not do, things we should not do when it comes to scented baits? Captain Scott, how are you, man? How was your weekend?
That was good. I spent it at Fish and Tackle Unlimited at the Salesman Sample
Sale. Oh, you
sale
talked about that last week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was stuck in there and then sat and watched. I had Sunday off, and I thought maybe I might go fish, but ended up doing a little yard work in the morning before the storm hit. I saw that thing coming.
Yeah.
They've been talking about it for 2 days.
Yeah.
And it had those straight line winds and possibility of little funnel clouds and water spouts out on the water. That's never fun.
Yeah.
So I just kind of avoided going out on Sunday. Then I saw a whole bunch of my friends jumping in there on Facebook saying that they were out there, some of them live Facebooking from the water while they were getting pounded. if you see it coming like that,
yeah,
just don't go.
That's on you, man.
It's not worth it.
All right. But we've all been out there and either misjudged our exit strategy and got stuck out in that stuff, or maybe it snuck up on us a lot quicker. I can think of two in particular for me that were, I mean, beyond white knuckle. I mean, you start, you know, coming to making your peace with God. I mean, I've been in a couple of those, and it's not fun. And that's why I wanted to talk to you about this, because you can die out there.
I've been on the water before. When I pulled back up to the dock, they were pulling body bags off of Parks and Wildlife boat and setting them on the dock.
You can die out there. So what do you do? I've been stuck in a storm like that. These waves were, I mean, when it blew in, it blew in. It was green, man. Yeah. It was really bad. I think the basic stuff is obvious. If you can get in, get in. But if it blows into you and it's, you know, I've been in 4 and 5 foot waves that are just, you know, just peppering you and you can't even.
Yeah, there's not much you can do.
Yeah.
If you're caught out in the open, in the middle of open bay, you can point the bow into it and just keep it on idle just enough to stay in one spot.
Mm-hmm.
Anchoring is sometimes not a real good idea because it pulls the bow of the boat under the water.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can keep the bow up a little bit by running the motor and move some people to the back of the boat, you know, that kind of thing, you can keep the bow up on a smaller boat.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing to do if you can, you know, and you're stuck, know which way it's coming from, know where your closest land is.
Yeah.
Whether it's a little island, I don't care if it's, you know, some little bird island out there in the mm-hmm. middle of nothing, beach your boat, beach it. Just run it in as shallow as it'll go and stop it. Once you're in that shallow of water, doesn't matter how big the waves are, you can't flip your boat over.
Mm-hmm.
And you're relatively safe then, other than the lightning.
Yeah.
You know, with the lightning, all you can do is put all your rods down, mm-hmm. antenna down if you've got one, and then lay down in the bottom of the boat.
Yep.
Get small. Cover up and get small. Those are the basic things. I mean, run straight to a shoreline
mm-hmm.
and beach it. Yeah, the closest one that you can find. When it's real bad. I'm talking like this one yesterday.
I've been in some storms
that.
Where you got to beat it and all that, but I'm talking like bad, like this past Sunday.
Right.
If you can get to someone's house on the shoreline or whatever, tie up and hold on. And by the way, tie up more than one rope.
Right.
I've seen it too many times. I've heard the stories. You know, if I don't care if I'm getting wet. Who cares about me getting wet? I usually tie 2 or 3 ropes to the cleats because storms like that are going to bust those ropes.
Storms can break ropes, and then also when it's pulling on it, it can loosen a knot up.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's or the bouncing. Cleat. It's bouncing so hard. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can loosen a cleat up, pull a cleat right off of a dock. I've seen that. You know, the belt and suspenders, man.
Yeah.
Go with both.
You got to use both.
I've tied up to those houses out there in the middle of the bay out mm-hmm. there in Port Mansfield before. Mm-hmm. And those are usually those little pop-up storms that just kind of catch you in July and August that come in off the Gulf.
Yeah.
They can be pretty vicious.
But you can ride them out relatively.
They're going to go away pretty quick.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've sat on many a porch over there, you know, kind of hunkered down, waiting mm-hmm. for it to go by, and then go catch fish afterwards.
Yeah, no, I've done that as well. But I've been in some where, you know, I was doing exactly what you were talking about. I think I remember going like, I had it at 7 miles per hour. And I was basically staying in one place, but every time I would hit the wave, the bow of my boat, a couple of times I thought it might flip me.
Yeah.
But you just got to stay right on it. You've got to steer a lot to stay directly perpendicular to those waves if you're in a storm.
And it's the time of year for it.
Mm-hmm.
Springtime has always been notorious for these late spring fronts
mm-hmm.
and real strong. I guess they're basically little cool fronts,
yeah.
But they can really build up a lot of steam on them.
Mm-hmm.
And what you look for now that we all have radar on our phone, you can see that line approaching. Get off the water, you know, before it comes in. But if you see it and it's a straight line,
mm-hmm.
you know it's not terrible. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be a wind shift, and it's probably going to be 20-30 mile an hour.
Yeah,
that's doable. If you see it bow and start pushing out
mm-hmm.
like a balloon towards you, that's when you need to get the hell off the water.
Yeah.
Because those are the ones that have the 50 and 60 mile an hour winds in them.
Sure. And, you know, we're all, you know, we all have our cell phones. Generally on a bay, you're going to have some kind of a signal. You can check. Even if, and it, by the way, these storms are not surprises. You know,
been predicted for 2 or 3 days that it was going to be bad.
Yeah, and you often, you know, misjudge getting off the water, or maybe it builds up from somewhere that it didn't show you on your radar. But generally, you see them coming, and you can, you know, at least adapt, okay, and start thinking in your mind, well, there's that island, there's those houses, you know, whatever, and find out how big it is. Like you said, if it's a big, big storm that's blowing out and it's going to be mean, just get the heck off, but, you know, before it's too late. But
well, the ones that bow out tend to come faster.
That's what I mean.
And that's when I've been caught before a couple of times by those fronts that it was supposed to be coming in at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and all of a sudden it rushed across the hill country and came down to the coast, and it's 11 or 12 o'clock.
Right.
You know, we thought we had, you know, another couple of hours. That was in the days before radar on a cell phone, too, though. Since radar on a cell phone, knock on wood, I have not been caught out in anything
like
that.
Yeah, that's the thing. They shouldn't be a surprise. But I get guys are guys, and we're hard-headed, and maybe we're catching fish, and we want to stay out there. Just use your common sense. Anything else as far as, like, if you do get stuck, that's a must that we're not talking about yet?
Well, I mean, if the boat is, you know, acting like it's going to get blown over or anything like that, just get out of it. Go stand in the go get in the grass and just stand there. You know, you got insurance on your boat.
Yeah.
You know, throw the anchor out or let it go up on the beach, whatever it's doing, and you can get out of it if you want to.
And even if it's just a little something that, you know, hey, we'll go ride this out, it doesn't hurt. Even when you're maybe I'm over cautious, but even when I've been in a bad storm and I sneak into somebody's dock lift, you know, boat lift, just to tie on and hold on while it's riding out, I still put a life jacket on.
The life jacket thing is a must. If you get caught in one of these things, it's time to put the life jacket on.
And a lot of guys have a lot of pride, or, you know, machismo or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, even if you're kind of tied up on the shoreline or a dock, something could hit you, something could get loose, something could, you know, whatever.
Things are flying in those storms.
Yeah, exactly. So those are just some things right there, and hopefully nobody will ever do it. They shouldn't be a surprise. Use your phone and the radar. And speaking of electronics, that's a good transition to our other point. I like this topic because I can, you know, you and I are both old enough. Well, we've been fishing without a GPS, without a cell phone.
Without any of it.
And so this dude, younger guy, friend of mine, I won't mention his name, said his GPS just went out. It wasn't a battery problem. He was running fine. He could have fished all day. But his GPS, you know, and he's mostly a drift fisherman, younger guy, but, you know, he says, like, I didn't know what to do. He goes, can y'all talk about this? Like, okay, so, you know, I was catching fish, and then it went out, it flickered, or the screen went out or something like that. And he goes, I didn't really know how to mark where I was, how to go back and do the same drift or where I started the drift or all that. I know you got your technique. Yeah. To this day, by the way, Scott, even though I have all these electronics, in my mind, I'm still thinking like I used to. Like, I look at...
You need to.
Yeah.
I mean, when GPS first came out, you know, one of my buddies got it, and he was all proud of it. And we would run out all the time out of Rockport and run over to Mud Island. You know, and we could just point it out in the open bay. We didn't have to use our little landmarks to guide ourselves. We're used to, I'd run towards this one landmark, and then about halfway there, I knew I needed to veer a little left when I picked up the next landmark further down.
Oh, yeah, navigation alone.
That was how we got around. Well, he had that, and he got to where he just depended on it really heavily. And it was the start of the war in Kuwait.
Okay.
It was when they did Desert Storm. And we were out fishing that morning when that started up. They shut down
the satellites.
The GPS.
Yeah, the satellites.
To everything but military, I guess. I don't know that they do that anymore, but back then, they just shut it all off. It scrambled it. And all of a sudden, while we were out on the water, his GPS wasn't working anymore. And I had to help him navigate back when it was time to come back by pointing out what we were looking at. You know, water towers, certain houses on the beach that are easy to see.
Yeah,
things like that I guess people just don't look at it anymore.
You take it for granted.
I always, as I'm leaving, I turn around, especially if it's a new area. As I'm heading out across the bay, when I get, you know, a few hundred yards out, I turn around and I look back
yep.
and figure out what's on that shoreline in the area where I launched from.
Mm-hmm.
I did it in Florida just recently, you know, when I was over there last year, a totally new area to me. And I knew basically where I could and
what
couldn't
does it look
go.
Like coming back right. is what I do. That's what
exactly.
you're talking about.
You want to pull out there and then just turn around and look 180 degrees behind you and line it up.
And I have, I'd like to think, and I know you do, I'd like to think I have a pretty good sense of direction. But sometimes you're out in the water, if there's a clouds, it's a little foggy, you get turned around, you're done. Yep. That's where a good old-fashioned compass.
Plain old good compass
yeah.
is worth its weight in gold.
Right.
And that, again, once you get out there and say you're going offshore,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're going to run, go to the beach.
And you're going north-northeast or whatever it is. But let's say south-southeast.
When you get outside the jetties and wait till you're 2, 3, 4 miles out, and then turn around and look back at the jetties, pick your landmarks, but also look at the compass mm-hmm. and see exactly. Go ahead and turn your boat around if you have to
yeah.
and point your boat so you'll get an idea of if some fog rolls in
mm-hmm.
or some low clouds come in over the bank up there and it's
right.
it shuts off that big
you
water tower.
The horizon.
Yeah. Now you have at least a general idea of which direction you need to go.
And, you know, I need to check my compass, but every once in a while you got to check those things too, especially the yep. smaller ones.
They can get off.
And make sure that they're still on. What about from a fishing perspective? This is what he was talking about too. I gave him a couple of thoughts on what we were just talking about, just navigation and how to use those markers and how to always, even if it takes 2 seconds, look over your shoulder and say, okay, kind of log it away like what you're talking about. Markers coming from where you're fishing, you know the markers back. But what about when you're actually fishing? He said he was frustrated because he never quite felt comfortable that he was fishing where he should have been fishing, where he'd caught some fish.
Right.
I still have on my boat, I think one, but I should have two, of those little floating buoys with a buoy with a weight on the bottom right. and then string. That's how we used to do it.
That was the only way that you, if you had specific places,
mm-hmm.
A specific reef or whatever, you could easily put those things
just
out.
Just drop it off, just throw it outside of the boat.
It just helped you work your drift the next time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you knew that I need, you know, mark where you started that drift.
Right.
And then if that drift didn't pay off, you just went and picked up your marker.
I did that a million times.
And moved somewhere else. But I would always mark myself
mm-hmm.
where I started a drift, because that may be the drift of the day, man. It may have been really a good one.
Right.
And I wanted to be able to repeat it. That and my way of doing it was just triangulation.
Mm-hmm.
And I could pick 3 spots on the shoreline and make a triangle out of it mm-hmm. and start figuring out exactly where I need to be. It wasn't pinpoint like it is now with GPS, of course, but it got me on the reef. Got me in the general area.
On your first point, that's why I always kept 2 of those. What are they even called? They're called little
marker buoys.
Yeah, marker buoys, a little weight on the bottom. I always kept 2 because I learned this a long time ago. I would drop one. If I'd say I caught a couple of fish and I said, oh, I'm going to go back and drift there, I would drop one at the start of the drift. I would also drop one when I ended my drift. And the reason I did that is so when I went back, sometimes the water and the wind and the currents change.
Things change a little.
Yeah, and so you want to make sure you stay on the right path of where you caught the fish rather than, well, I started there, so I'm on the right path. Not necessarily.
Right.
You keep that second buoy in front of you so you can say, okay, I got to adjust a little bit to the left or to the right or whatever.
And the
other thing, you say triangulation. Let's say there's a duck blind on the shoreline. And you like kind of eyeball it. You're like, yeah, I think I'm in the right spot. Oh, boy, that's dangerous because you can be off 20, 50, 100 feet if you
right.
just use one marker on the shoreline. You have to go sideways and maybe a crab trap in front of you, you know, or something like that and triangulate it.
I like to find things that are on the shoreline, the far shoreline, a certain house.
Yeah.
You know, a house that's got more of a peaked roof, you know, or something different that's on a shoreline, a radio tower, whatever mm-hmm. it is. Those things are permanent. So that, or at least mostly permanent.
They're stable.
And that way, the next time I came out, I'd still had those markers.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas duck blinds, sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not.
Yeah, right.
You know, they get blown over. Of course, crab trap buoys, they get moved around all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I always tried to find something permanent.
Some static.
On the land.
Yeah.
That I could count on.
And by the way, these things are not, I mean, you know, a lot of kayakers listen to us. a lot of guys on smaller boats that don't have GPS. And I'm sure they all have their own techniques of how to mark and help themselves catch fish. But those are some things, the shoreline points of reference, the compass, the weighted markers, those kinds of things. It's always a possibility that your GPS or electronics is going to go out.
And kayak fishing in the marsh, like I said, we didn't have GPSs mm-hmm. when I was doing that when I started it. And that was a really big thing of turning around and seeing what it looked like going back. Because you get yourself going, you're fishing, you're zigzagging through a marsh. Mm-hmm. You know, you got little bayous and little lakes. And all of a sudden,
you don't know where you are.
You can't figure out where in the heck you are and how to get back out of there. It's like a maze.
Mm-hmm.
So I would always, every time I'd leave or enter a lake in the marsh, turn around and look back
mm-hmm.
after I got a little ways away from it and say, okay, that's what the entrance looked like.
Yeah.
And just log it away. You can stand up out there, but you're not going to be very high.
Yeah.
You know, by the time you're standing in a little bit of mud and mm-hmm. knee deep water and then some grass, your head's not that far above the grass.
Mm-hmm.
You can stand up in your kayak. You know, most of them today are stable enough, so you get a little better view. But it's real easy to get turned around out there when you're low down.
It's a good idea just to do these things. I still do them. I have GPS. I have all the electronics, got the cell phone. Maybe it's just force of habit from the old days, but it's a good thing to get into. You learn the water, first of all, and you learn all the shorelines, the ins and outs and everything. You know, it's a good thing to just log those things away, even if you have the electronics.
The kayak paddle trails,
yeah,
like Lighthouse Lakes and mm-hmm. places like that. The way they started was a friend of mine, Bill Harvey,
mm-hmm.
worked for Parks and Wildlife. And he loved kayak fishing, and he went out there and was in the Lighthouse Lakes, which is all mangroves.
Yeah.
And you can stand up all you want.
You can't see nothing.
You can't see the road. You can't get a whole good bearing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he had gotten out there and he hurt his shoulder,
mm-hmm.
Flipping the, you know, had like a little holding, incident.
Like trying to pick it up?
Well, the kayak kind of flipped on him mm-hmm. a little bit, and he reached out, caught himself. I think that's what this mm-hmm. way it was. Anyway, he bummed his shoulder up a little bit, and so he started heading back in, and he got turned around and ended up out there. I don't know if he spent the night or if he came in way after dark, but it was pretty late.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, he got in one of the Parks and Wildlife planes, and they started mapping the place out and coming up with a route through there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they came up with all those markers that you see.
Yeah.
And then that expanded up and down the coast. They started doing more of them.
Well, that's what you need. That's cool. Cause it, you get turned around. It's scary too. You feel like stupid, first of all, and then you get worried cause you can't get out of there.
Well, he could hear the traffic on 361.
Oh man.
And he would move towards the traffic, but it was a dead end.
Oh
yeah. And then he would have to go find some
other
way.
And then by the time you backtracked in, you did another one.
Now you're lost even more because you backtracked out thinking you were on your way out of here. He said just listening to the traffic, he knew he wasn't that far away.
Yeah.
It's just there wasn't any way to get from here to there.
Yeah. That's crazy. All right. This is another good question from a listener. And it's frustrating. We've all been there to a degree anyway, but he says he's just missing too many fish. He says he listens to our podcast. And by the way, if you want to send your questions yourself, you can send it to me at Lopez on Sports on Twitter. You can message me, Lopez on Sports on Instagram. But we get a lot of our texts and messages from Captain Scott Null on Facebook and myself, John Lopez, on Facebook. You can send us what you want. But this is a good question. He says, I feel like I'm doing everything right. I'm getting bites. And I think this was one particular weekend. He said he had 2 days where he just felt like his batting average was, you know, minimal, like 50%, less than 50%, I think he said. Well, that's bad. You got to do more than 50%. I get it. Sometimes they're finicky and all that. But in a general sense, you know, what is it? Is it equipment? Is it user error? Or is the answer yes?
Pretty much yes. I mean, it can be a lot of things. It depends on if you're using bait or you're throwing lures.
I think he was using lures, but we can address both.
Yeah, you know, if you're using bait, sometimes it's just small fish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're picking at it and not really eating it. Change locations.
Mm-hmm.
That's your best bet for that. If your shrimp is losing its little legs and you're bringing it in and all the kicker legs on it are all missing, that means you got some piggy perch, you got mm-hmm. some little fish messing around. Just go ahead and change locations because they're going to drain you nuts. With lures, what I find a lot of times is they're short striking, soft plastics.
Mm-hmm.
They're grabbing the tail.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look at
they'll bite the tail at the end of a plastic.
They'll bite the tail clean off.
Yeah.
take your soft plastic and look at it and see if there's any bite marks, rough spots, mm-hmm. looks like sandpaper behind the hook. And then you can tell if they're short striking. I don't know why they do it, but it does happen ever so often.
Mm-hmm.
I go with a shorter bait. Even what I used to do is just bite mine off.
Mm-hmm.
I kept one size of soft plastics. I'd be fishing it full size. I started getting those little short strikes. I'd bite an inch of it off, put it back, bite the head off.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, bite the head off and then put it right back on the hook
mm-hmm.
and then start catching fish.
It could be your hooks, you know, it could be, you know, eagerness, you know, and so you maybe, you know, are feeling bites that aren't there necessarily, depending on if you're on a shell bottom or whatever. But my suggestion would be, you know, keep trying to set that hook, because with today's technology, assuming you have good hooks, good bait, good line and all that, that you're not going to miss. You're going to have your day. You know what I mean? It might have just been a bad weekend with some ladyfish or whatever.
Yeah, the new rods are so sensitive.
Yeah.
I mean, with a jig head on, I can tell you if it's a sand bottom or a mud bottom.
Yeah.
Or if I'm ticking shell.
Mm-hmm.
So you can feel everything. So that's why those short strikes, I think we feel more of them now than we used to.
Mm-hmm.
Old fiberglass rods, if they were short striking, we wouldn't know it.
Right.
You know, they're just bumping it. I think that's part of the problem, is we feel everything now,
mm-hmm.
and not every fish is just slamming into your lure and eating it full-hearted. You
right.
know?
And I would say, you know, keep doing what you're doing unless it's clearly, you know, a user error, but you'll get your hookups. Maybe it was just a bad weekend, but I know a lot of people are like, man, you know, this guy's catching a bunch. And it also could be the bait you're using, you know, they'll hit other baits harder. And you and I are both advocates of not so much the color as the profile. Maybe change it to something similar or something different that would be, it would draw a better bite.
And topwaters are notorious for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They'll blow if you're it clean out of the water.
You're missing shots with topwaters, just join a club.
Yeah.
And it happens a lot. I mean, they just knock them around until they get hooked up.
Mm-hmm.
If they're real aggressive, there are days when they just tail slap it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trout, you can see it. The trout will come up there, and I don't know if it's because they're irritated at it and they're trying to kill it. I don't know what they're doing.
They'll hit it.
You can see a tail come up and just pop it.
Mm-hmm.
You can see them just slash at them, and with no real intent.
But they knock it out of the water.
I've caught a lot of trout. How many trout have you caught outside the mouth?
Oh,
the
yeah. top water. Well, the top water for sure.
I think sometimes they're just trying to kill it. It's irritating them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, there's no telling what they're really thinking. But if that's happening
coffee
to you,
that way too.
If that's happening to you, then go subsurface.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's why
start
I'm
soft
on this
plastic.
Big, you know, I'm on this big twitch bait kick right now because I think it's better hookups than a top water.
And
whenever
it is.
Whenever it's that time.
Tops are your lowest percentage mm-hmm. of all the lures
the
that we
fun.
Throw.
Most fun,
mm-hmm. and that's what I'll do most of the time, starting mm-hmm. off in the morning
yeah.
until they prove me wrong.
Sure.
That's the way I'll start it. But, yeah, if your hookup percentage is always going to be lower on those.
And I get it. It gets frustrating. We've all had those days. We're like, dang, man. But, you know, just try some of those things. I generally just switch to a smaller bait or a different profile. I don't bite the plastic off like Scott does. But I tend to go ahead and buy the smaller bait. But that's just me. And we talk about, presuming he's working, let's say, with a topwater, since we're on that topic. Those rusty hooks, man. I mean,
yeah, rusty hooks, and even hooks that when they bump shell,
mm-hmm.
you know, they bump something hard, you can roll that tip over pretty easy on a lot of these
yeah.
hooks. They're so sharp and they're so pointed. If it hits something, you know, oyster shells, whatever.
You get hooked up on oyster
yeah,
shells.
Yeah, and that's going to roll that tip over a little mm-hmm. bit. It might not penetrate quite as easy. I don't know.
The short story, keep hacking.
Yeah, keep trying.
Yeah, you'll get it. You'll get them.
Drag that hook across your thumbnail.
It's got a hook. It's got a catch.
And see if it's going to catch.
Yeah.
If it catches, you know, at a little bit of an angle and drag it across your thumbnail, it should bite in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't just slide.
And that's a good hook.
And that's a good hook.
My dad taught me about that a long time ago.
Yeah, and tarpon fishing like I do.
Oh, well, tarpon,
you
that's
have
the fish.
To have a sharp. I mean, you got to have a sharp, sharp hook
mm-hmm.
and a luck.
Yeah.
On top of a sharp hook. But, yeah, that's where I use a sharpener fairly regularly.
To do it.
Is just touch it up. And fly fishing, too.
Mm-hmm.
If you're using a real, real light flippy rod, you know, mm-hmm. with your conventional gear, and somewhat similar to using a fly rod. You better have some sharp hooks, because you got to drive the hook home, especially on redfish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those little rubbery lipped redfish.
I don't get cheated on my hook sets. I don't.
You Bill Dance them.
No, I mean, I've had some guys say, oh, you know, trout have that soft, sensitive mouth. You don't want to set the hook too hard. And that's true. They do have that. I think you can give it a pretty good, hack, and you won't be pulling anything out of anybody's lip.
Yeah, I don't set it really all that hard anymore. Back in the days of mono,
mm-hmm.
you know, when that's all we use, mono stretched so much. That's when the old Bill Dance hook set really became popular.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had to bring it to set the hook. Now with all the new lines.
Oh, they'll hook set themselves too.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm saying I'll pull it back
with braided line.
Yeah.
Whatever you move that rod tip, that's how far that lure is moving.
Mm-hmm.
So I do generally smaller hook sets.
Right.
If I do miss, I want that lure to still be in the same zip code.
Exactly. I don't know about mine. All right. Hey, we had a good sight fishing discussion last week, but we need to add some more to it. We had a couple of questions one question from a listener said, please cover whatever you can on poling skiffs next podcast. I don't think you got all of it last week. And you wanted to add something too from the sight fishing perspective.
Yeah, the question had been about conventional and fly. Mm-hmm. Where we ended up going kind of off on just the conventional side, and we really didn't talk about the fly fishing, sight casting. There's not a huge difference with it, except that more practice. You really have to practice that. The reason it came up is that one of my customers was out with me, and we had some really spooky fish,
mm-hmm.
and he wasn't even able to get cast off to them,
right?
Because he needed two or three back casts, you know, false casts, mm-hmm. with a fly rod to get going and get his cast out there, and they were gone by the time he did it.
Yeah,
they start feeling the boat, they see the movement.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty sharp when they're in that shallow water. You got to figure a fish in real shallow water is very vulnerable.
Yeah,
yeah, he's vulnerable to birds. You know, an osprey can fly over.
Right.
And ever since they were little bitty,
yeah.
they knew that they could get eaten when they're up there in that shallow water.
Yeah.
So even when they get to be 25, 26 inch fish,
mm-hmm.
they still have that innate fear of anything from overhead.
Right.
So when you start moving and you're above them,
that'll get them out of there. Yeah, that'll get them out of there.
And it'll spook them. So with fly fishing, sight casting, practice taking one back cast. You know, pick it up off the water with one cast,
mm-hmm.
one back cast, and then put it back down. Practice that in the yard. Practice it wherever you are. The way I did it, I put Coke cans out in the yard,
mm-hmm.
and I practiced hitting those Coke cans with one back cast.
Mm-hmm.
And I had cans scattered 10, 15, 20 feet apart.
Mm-hmm.
And I would pick it up off of the can on the left and hit the far can on the right with one back cast. You completely change directions in your cast.
Yeah.
You practice that over and over and over again, and your catch ratio will go way up.
And fly fishing, if you're a fly fisherman from Colorado or something, it's a whole different world down here when you're saltwater,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's not anything the same. When I have guys that are coming from out of state, and they say, oh, I've been fly fishing for 20 years. Where'd you fly fish? You know, you caught bonefish? What have you done? Oh, man, I've been up in the streams in the mountain. I've caught just tons of rainbow trout and cutthroats and all.
What's the biggest difference? They don't have as many back casts, for one, right?
Well, they don't cast anywhere near as far as
the distance,
do.
Yeah.
And a roll cast is, mm-hmm. that's a main thing in your bag, you mm-hmm. know, when you're shooting up there in the little streams. You just got to pick it up and roll it.
Yeah.
And you do what's called a roll cast, and it just picks your fly up off the water and puts it another 5 feet out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't do that in salt water.
Yeah.
I mean, a roll cast will work every once in a while, but mostly in salt water, it's more aggressive.
Aren't you just casting 50 feet at the most?
Yeah, 30 to 50 feet for the most part will catch mm-hmm. you a redfish.
Yeah.
It's not that far,
right.
But it's the way you have to do it. Mm-hmm. It's faster. You got to be on them quicker. You got to be a little more precise, get some pinpoint. And then you got to be ready for the strike as soon as it hits,
because
you get some reaction strikes, so you can't let loose of the line with your free hand,
mm-hmm.
that you're holding the line with when you cast. Don't let go of it and let it just, you know, because then you got to find that line again,
right?
And while you're trying to look at a fish, there's a whole lot to it on mm-hmm. fly fishing. It can get kind of complicated, and you can overthink it a little bit too.
Yeah.
But you're generally just, you know, as soon as you see the fish, you got to cast to the fish.
I generally am. Yeah. I mean, by the, when I see the fish and I've pointed it out to you, even if you haven't seen it yet, mm-hmm. I'm telling you, okay, he's at
9 o'clock.
He's at 10 o'clock mm-hmm. at 35, 40 feet, and he's moving left or right. That gets you in the general area. Now point your rod. If you don't see it, what I tell all my guys, if you don't see the fish that I'm talking about, point your rod where you think I'm talking.
Yeah.
And okay, that's more like 11 o'clock. Go yeah. left, go left, go a little bit left.
And then
I'll say left, 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 left. Okay, right there.
Yeah.
And then you're pointing your rod at it, and a lot of times that'll help them see it.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I have a lot of my customers who really can't see fish that well.
Yeah.
You know, older guys,
yeah.
whatever, they're just not used to it, can't see them. And they'll just trust me.
Mm-hmm. Just throw it.
I'll say, point your rod. And they'll point it, and I say, right there, 30 feet. And they make a cast. And some of these guys are really, really good at it.
They know what 30 feet is.
They drop it in there. Yeah. And they just have full trust that I'm pointing a fish out to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it works out really well that way. The ones that have the biggest, hardest problem are the ones who won't cast until they see the fish.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that fish has already seen us by then, and he's taken
yeah.
off.
Yeah. But, well, the other part of the question was about poling skiffs, which you're an expert on that as well. By the way, it's CaptainScottNull.com if you want to get in with him on some of these great fly fishing trips. Poling skiffs, those are getting so popular right now.
Man, it's unbelievable what's happened with poling skiffs.
Mm-hmm.
When I started poling, probably it's getting close to 20 years now. I hate to think it like that. But when I started off, there was one poling skiff in Galveston. Besides me. And that was it. There was only two of us out there.
Yeah.
And we looked like the odd ducks out there, you know, on the water. People just looked at you like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
Now, further south, there was more of them,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the clearer water and more Florida-like
yeah.
thing. And these things came out of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where they originated. But they've been modified over time. The hulls have been modified to fit more of the Texas
right.
coast. In Florida, when they start talking about flats fishing in Florida, mm-hmm. they're talking about 2 feet, 3 feet deep.
Yeah. We call that deep.
Yeah, I mean, that's wading deep.
Yeah.
Over here, 6 inches to a foot is where I'm prowling around most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
The little Sabine that I just got, I'm really impressed with how shallow that thing goes.
Yeah.
When you come out and get on it, mm-hmm. you'll be surprised.
It doesn't feel natural.
It doesn't look like.
Yeah.
I mean, I loved my Ace Cape. I had it for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
I had never fished a boat for 7 years like mm-hmm. that. And you get a feel for when you're in that shallow water, how deep something is.
Yeah.
You know, you get a really good feel for it. And then you start knowing, I can't go over that because yeah. I'm going to bump.
Yeah.
You know, that oyster right there, I'm going to bump that. And so I still have that gauge instinct. In my
yeah.
head.
Yeah.
of being on that boat. Well, this one's floating a solid, it doesn't sound like much, but it's a solid inch to 2 inches shallower.
That's a big difference in eight
when
inches.
When you start talking 6 inches to 8 inches,
yeah.
I mean, you know, it's a big difference.
What do people need to know about, first of all, it's a little more affordable, you know, the price range.
I'm saying
some of them can be exactly like any other boat, yeah. but if you want to get started, like an entry level, it's a little more affordable, but it's a whole different tactic and technique. I mean, first of all, you got to go over water to get to the skinny water, so you've got to have a boat that can handle that.
That can handle the rougher water.
Yeah.
There are some of them out there that are really good poling skiffs. I owned one at one time that I just couldn't stand that boat.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it in shallow water.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it when I was poling it.
But you got beat
fishing,
around?
But you'd get wet everywhere you went.
Which one was it?
That was my Maverick.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to even throw that out there. But,
no, that's
but
all right.
Yeah, I mean, my
they fixed
Maverick,
it since then.
hopefully they've done something with that. That was quite a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And but if I had anything over 12 to 15 miles an hour,
you're done.
Which is constant here.
Yeah.
They've got more protected water in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So they're used to being able to be up in the mangroves.
Yeah, you got to cut across bays here.
We got to cut across some open water here.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime I'd have to cut across anything like that, we were going to get wet.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a matter of how wet were we going to get. And I hated getting customers wet. And
yeah.
that's when I went to the East Cape, and it's got big, huge bow flare on it. And it directs the water down
right.
off of you. I could run across pretty much any bay that was safe
mm-hmm.
and not get wet in that boat.
Yeah, you're not going to be out there in 20, 25.
Right.
You know, but...
And now I've got the same thing with this one. It's got such a huge overhang on the sides and at the bow.
It just
knocks all that water down. It pushes it all down. That's where the evolution of poling skiffs has gone. Is drier boats, lighter weight boats. You pay for all of that.
Yeah.
You know, there's some carbon fiber boats out there.
Well, yours is what, 450 pounds?
Yeah, mine's like I want to say Brian said it was 550.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there. Between 5 and 550.
Yeah.
My old one was roughly the same, 550, 600 pounds. So
what people need to know?
They keep getting lighter and lighter.
On actual pull. Like, I want to get into pulling. I like the skinny water. I've done some wading. I've done some kayaking. I'm ready to upgrade. I want to get into poling skiffs just like Captain Scott. I mean, what's the tutorial that you can help them with?
It sounds self-serving, but get a guide.
Yeah.
And go out. If you've got a particular boat in mind, like I've got one guy that called me today. He's thinking about buying a Sabine and he wants to go out on it. You can go out on a test ride all you want, but
you got to see it working.
Book a guide and fish it.
Yeah.
Because these boats fish different than what you think. They're a little tippy sometimes. You know, side to side. If you're not comfortable with that, then you don't need to be in a poling skiff. Yeah. But what I see is a lot of guys are coming from kayaks and getting poling skiffs.
That's what I'm thinking.
That's where most of them seem to be coming from. And so you're used to tippy in a kayak.
Yeah, that's true.
But you're fishing kind of the same areas. And I call my poling skiffs a kayak with a motor because I go to the same places I used to go in kayaks.
How wide is yours?
6 foot.
That's not bad.
7 foot.
No, so you can get a good.
I can get way back in there.
Yeah.
And so there's all different price ranges in them. You can get a basic, very basic hull, no bells and whistles, or you can work your way all the way up to a full on carbon fiber.
Right.
Weighs 17, 18 foot boat that weighs 300 and something pounds and floats in nothing. But that one's $60,000+ for a poling skiff. So there's so many different ones that are available now. When I first got into it, it was maybe three or four that were fairly popular. Now there's a dozen, the different models, different things that you can get into. So that's why I said find out who's got one. Like, this guy wants to come out and spend a day with me on the boat. Just hire a guide for the day,
And you'll be able to see how to pole. There is a technique. How to angle into fish.
Yeah, when you first start poling, you're going to go in circles.
You're going to feel like you got two left feet.
You're going to zigzag across a flat, or you're going to go in circles in a marsh, trying to make a turn. It's all about it's all technique. It's touch. You don't put a whole lot of effort into it. If you push hard, you're screwing up.
You're doing it wrong.
Yeah, because you're gonna overcompensate, and so now you're moving a little bit too far left. So you stick your pole in, you push to go right.
Yeah.
Well, now you just start duck walking across the flat, and it looks silly.
It's just hand over hand, nice and easy, right?
Go easy. Yeah. Very small, light touches for the most part. Unless there are situations when the wind's blowing hard,
sure,
or a fish blows up behind me, and I got to spin the boat around. That's one thing to test out on a boat. How fast can you spin that thing around?
Yeah, and practice.
The one I've got now, that Sabine, I can completely spin that boat around inside of itself.
Meaning, oh, really? Like a it's on an axis.
Like it's on an axis. I mean, I can spin that boat around in a heartbeat, and that comes in real handy fishing in the marsh and places like that, because a fish blows up behind you.
Just do it.
You can spin the boat around and get your guy on.
And I bet that happens a lot.
Happens a whole lot. Not all boats spin and turn the same.
And that's all boats. I was telling you last week about how mine, every boat I've had drifts a different way.
And my Sabine, I can spin it around really quick. It may not track quite as well across an open water with a crosswind because it is more flat on the bottom.
Right.
As opposed to one that's got a little bit of V to the bottom, you can't go as shallow, but it'll help you track faster.
Right.
You know, a straight line much better. There's so many little nuances with poling skiffs. They're so lightweight. Weight distribution is a huge thing on them.
You can go clean off the side of those things.
Well, yeah, you can fall off of them.
Yeah.
But the weight distribution thing, Like my old, my first one was a Mitzi. It was a 17 foot Mitzi. Real, real lightweight boat, fun boat. It had to have somebody on the bow of it. If I was on the back poling, like scouting by myself, the front end would lift up out of the water so far that any kind of wind would just spin you around. So what I started doing was carrying a big,
like Yeti, an ice bucket.
Big Yeti cooler.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my big ones, like 65 quart. And I would have a 5-gallon bucket, and I'd fill that thing up with water up on the bow. And that was the only like way another you could, person you know, being on the bow, and that would keep the bow down. So you have to really work with your weight distribution in there. Where you store your gear and where your customers ride, where your buddy rides, makes a huge difference on a poling skiff.
But clearly you swear by them.
It's my favorite way of getting around in the marsh, by far. And that's all I ran for a long time until I started doing this tarpon thing.
Yeah.
And even when I started off playing with a tarpon out there, I was still running a poling skiff.
Offshore?
I mean, just run out there early in the morning when
it was
calm.
Don't do this at home, kids.
And there, you'll see, you go out of Port O'Connor, you'll see three or four of them out there.
I've seen some John
day.
Boats out there.
And
those are the guys that freak me out. Well, I'm out there a little nervous, you know, in my little 19 foot Scout.
Yeah.
And then I see some dude in a 14 foot John boat. And I'm like, oh, man.
Well, I would run out there in the mornings, and then invariably in the summertime when it's dead slick calm and you're out there having fun, that little puff of wind.
Yeah, here comes the wind.
And then by 2 o'clock, the wind's blowing 20, and then I would have a hard time coming in through Pascavallo and through the jetties because it got too daggum rough for that little boat. And so one per day in particular, I pushed it a little too far and was nervous about whether or not I was getting back in or not.
No kidding.
And couldn't figure out how to get through Pascavallo. I mean, the waves were just crossing every which way. And then the jetties, the waves were standing up because the tide was going out. And I ended up surfing a wave in. And
I'm laughing because I've done that. Because I've done, you got to time it just right.
Get your, it just right.
Get your idle just right, or your acceleration.
And feather the throttle back and forth and just try to stay on the face of that thing.
I've done that exact same thing.
That's how I got in. And at that point was when I said, you know, I'm going to start looking
Dargle.
A second boat. And that's when I ended up with a Dargle.
Well, that's good stuff. I mean, and plus, you know, the big takeaway is find a guy that, like yourself, that knows what
buddy
they're doing.
Or something. Try them before you buy
what they're doing.
Definitely try out your poling skiff before you go spend any money on it. And by try it out, I don't mean running in a circle in Clear Lake. That's not the way to do it.
Right.
You want to go out and fish that boat, walk around the edges of it, stand on the side of it, see how tippy it really is, get up on the poling platform and push it around for a few minutes. I have customers all the time. Can I pole your boat? You know, I want to see what it's like up there.
Yeah.
And they get up and they do it for 5 or 10 minutes and we go in circles and zigzag. And they say, man, it's harder than it looks.
Well, I've told you, technically mine is a poling skiff. It's just it's a big, heavier boat.
Yours
it's
made Florida. For the Florida.
Yeah, it's for Florida.
3 foot flats.
But I use that platform in the back mostly as a chair when I don't want to stand up fishing anymore. But I've stood up there, man. You see the world a whole different way.
Oh, yeah. That's the whole joy of being in a poling skiff.
You see it a whole different way.
I learned more about redfish. I mean, I knew a lot about them from all the years of prowling around in the back marshes and john boats and kayaks. But once I got a poling skiff, I learned so much more about them because I could sit up there.
Even if you're not fishing, you see how they interact.
I would
pull
up in a marsh at an intersection where I knew some fish might be moving through, and I'd pull up and just sit. And just watch and see how those fish interacted with the deeper water, the shallower water,
the whole ecosystem,
the grass. Yeah. You know, how were they, you know, going next to each other? How does a school swim together? But from up there, man, you've got a bird's eye view. You can see
how
everything.
How high are your eyes? Mine would be real high.
On my poling skiff, I'm probably.
I think on mine, I'd be at least 9 feet high.
I'm probably higher than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. My eye level is at least 10 feet.
Yeah, it's right in that area.
And, you know, cause if you stood next to my boat, you're looking up at the platform and then add my height to it. Yeah, I'd say my eye level is probably at least 10 feet off
that's
the water.
And then mine, you know, similarly, and I don't do it. I just, like, you know, I just fish conventional. But whenever I do get up there for fun, it's an eye-opening experience, no pun intended.
It's fun.
Yeah.
And it's just so much fun to be able to see the fish and watch them bite.
Right.
You know, watching a redfish track a fly or a lure.
That's a
and
hoot.
As he's coming and you know he's fired up and he's going to eat, that's a lot of fun.
All right, let's hit a couple of topics here that I'm not going to say controversial because it's often discussed. Swivels. To swivel or not to swivel? That is the question. I don't even know, you know, you and I haven't even really talked about this too much. I very, very rarely use a swivel. And I know some people think that's blasphemous. I tie right on to just about everything. With the right knot, I think it gets a better action. Again, and this is why we do the podcast. That's me. That's how I fish best. That's where I have the most confidence. You know, tie the right knot, being able to work the bait the way you want. I have used some swivels occasionally, but 90% of the time I don't. Where do you stand?
Well, there's two different things here. You're talking about a snap swivel.
Right.
You know, where you attach the lure to the swivel.
Mm-hmm.
No. I'm not big on that.
Right.
I've seen too many snap swivels fail over the years.
Mm-hmm.
They can pull loose. There's some really good ones out there. If you want to use that,
mm-hmm.
There's some more expensive ones. Go ahead and spend a little bit of money on it. We're not talking much. But the one, if you look at the shelf and there's one for 99 cents and there's one for $3
yeah.
in a package, get the $3 one. Because mm-hmm. that 99 cent one's going to cause you a heartache.
Right.
Straight swivel, barrel swivel.
Like a barrel swivel.
Where it's you're tying something on either end of it. Those I use.
For the leader.
I use it like with live shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a sliding weight above that. Then I've got the swivel that stops the weight from going down to the hook. Then mm-hmm. I've got a little bit of leader, however much I'm using on that particular time, then the hook. That's a good time to have it because your bait will spin in the water sometimes.
Yeah.
Now that'll twist your line.
I will do that for bait. Like I've often said on this, like after I go fishing, I generally sit in the backyard and eat and have a cold beverage and just soak dead shrimp or live shrimp. That I will do. I was thinking more with my lures.
Throwing lures.
Yeah.
I see guys that do it, and I don't. They'll put 2 or 3 feet of line on for
mm-hmm.
a leader.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, say, you know, you want to throw some fluorocarbon on the end of your braid.
Right.
And they'll tie off to a swivel and have that swivel onto the braid
mm-hmm.
and then fluorocarbon from there to the lure. The problem is you need to stop that thing before it goes through that eye tip.
Right.
You don't want that swivel bouncing through the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen guys reel it all the way through their eyes and then cast, and that's brutal
yeah.
on your rod.
Yeah.
It's gonna pop an eye. It's gonna scratch an eye. It's gonna mm-hmm. make a bad spot. The times that they do that is usually throwing spoons, and sometimes on these rat tail lures,
mm-hmm.
the soft plastics,
yeah.
they tend to spin a little bit. When you're casting, they spin. When they're coming back, if you're working them fast,
on the
sometimes
swivel,
they'll spin.
The swivel will spin.
Right.
Yeah.
So the way to get around that and not have the swivel hitting your rod tip,
mm-hmm.
take a split ring and attach a split ring to the eye of your jig head.
Okay.
Now put your swivel on that split ring.
Mm-hmm.
And now tie onto the swivel.
Gotcha.
So the swivel is touching your lure.
Mm-hmm.
And I do it on every spoon that I've got. And my guys throw a lot of spoons, mm-hmm. sight cast into reds.
Mm-hmm.
Every spoon that you'll see on my boat is rigged that way.
Right.
I rig them at the house so I don't have to mess with that split ring on the
you
water.
You put a split ring on the tip of the spoon?
Put a split ring on the eye where mm-hmm. you would normally tie on.
Yeah.
And then slide your
right.
your barrel swivel onto that. Now tie onto that.
Right.
And if you're wanting to use lure or a leader, then learn to tie an FG knot mm-hmm. or whatever your favorite knot is. Mine's
right.
the FG knot. Then you can tie that on. The knot going through back and forth through the eyes isn't a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But a metal swivel bouncing through those eyes is going to crack something.
My thing on swivels is why are you really doing it is important. Because like why you're doing it is for the action and to catch more fish.
And to keep from twisting your line.
Right, for the action. Yeah. A lot of guys do it for convenience so they can keep switching baits. I think two
right.
things happen. Number one, you're going to switch baits far too many times, and we've discussed that. It's really profile more than anything. So, you know, hey, I got a swivel. I can switch it right away. And number two, I don't trust the swivel as much as directly on the line. I mean, you have the best – I used to use swivels a lot more, but you have the best lines available right now with braided line,
right,
that are practically invisible, however you want, whatever color you want, however you want to use it. The less stuff between me and the fish, in my opinion, the better.
Right.
You know, everything I have, top waters.
Everything is a point of failure.
Yep, exactly. Yeah,
anything that is in there, mm-hmm. in that, and so you want the fewest possibilities for failure in there. That snap swivel thing just drives me nuts. There's a third thing to okay. that. When you catch fish, you check your leader, right?
Mm-hmm.
You feel it. Well, a guy who's got a snap swivel on there, he doesn't like tying knots, obviously, because he's got a snap swivel.
Right.
And he's tending to switch out those lures. That line needs to be retied ever so often. When you're catching fish on a regular basis, mm-hmm. you need to feel that line. If it's got a nick in it at all, clip it off,
yeah.
retie it. I kind of have a feeling that the guy who's using a snap swivel a whole lot is not going to be doing that.
Yeah.
And he's taking a good chance of breaking off.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, and the other part of it is not only I want the least possible number of things between me and the fish, and number two, it also makes you tend to change out your bait far more than you would normally. I can tie a knot just as fast.
Right.
Most guys, if you fish enough on the water, I can tie a knot and a bait, whatever yeah. bait, in, I don't know, 30 seconds?
Yeah, you should be able to. Yeah. If you're fishing on a regular, and most guys who are out there
know what they're
throwing lures yeah. and doing things, they know how to tie a knot pretty mm-hmm. quick. There's so many different good knots out there. And there's little apps and websites sure. and things that you can look them up, and they have cartoon drawings of it, you know, as the line goes through how right. to make the different knots. So there's really no excuse anymore for not knowing how to tie a good knot.
Mm-hmm. It's all they do, a YouTube video. All right, one more thing here. Also, sort of, people tend to dig their heels in on one side or the other, and that is scents. The baited, obviously, I'm not talking about a gulp. I'm talking about using an actual right. squeeze bottle scent on baits. Trout have very keen senses of smell and vision. So does adding scents to baits, I've seen people do it on every bait, spoons, topwaters, soft plastics, does that really help?
I don't know. I mean, I know guys that swear by it, mm-hmm. the Procure, things right. like that.
Right.
Where I could see it working is on a corky, something where you're working it really slow and yeah. it's just hanging there.
Yeah.
I could see it maybe working on that. But I think most of our predator fish, redfish, mm-hmm. trout, Spanish mackerel, whatever, are charging that lure because of what it looks like.
Correct.
They're not going up there and sniffing it. You know, once they've committed,
this looks suspicious.
Yeah, they've committed to it, and they're coming up to it to eat it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that doesn't smell right. I don't know that they do that. I don't know. It's never really been something that I've subscribed to.
I don't have a bottle in my boat.
Yeah,
I don't have a single bottle in my boat. However, I don't want to discourage people from doing it if you're confident in that.
Right.
You know, because we always go back to that.
Sure. If it adds a little bit of confidence and keeps you out there for another hour mm-hmm. because you've got your scented bait,
mm-hmm.
by all means, do it. You know, if it makes you make three more casts, go ahead and do it. It's just not something that I've ever really gotten into, partly because of the mess. You know,
and the time.
The stink, the mess, the, you know, all those things. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know. I really don't know that our predators take the time to sniff it. Yeah.
And trout, to me, they're great visual predators.
Right.
You know, they go from the dirty water to the clear water, the dirty streak, as people like to say.
Right.
And they go from structure and protection to the clean. They have a great keen sense of smell, but their visionary. I don't know if that's right. They're visual predators more than anything. So I think it goes back to what the bait looks like. Now I will say this, Scott, and see what your thoughts are. I am a little bit anal about my hands on these baits. Like, I never put sunblock on before I rig.
And I put gas in the boat at the end of the day.
I do it right before I put the boat up.
I don't put gas in the boat in the morning.
So you're kind of along the same lines as me. I'm a little bit wary that my scents might turn fish off.
Chemical.
Yeah.
You know, the gasoline smell, oil smell. Mm-hmm. I think that that might, if it's on the bait, it's not so much that they shy away from it as they're swimming up to it, because like I said, they're coming to kill it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it might make them turn loose of it a little bit faster.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's one thing on the scented baits. People would say, well, why does gulp work then?
Mm-hmm.
I think that has more to do with how long they hold on to it.
Mm-hmm.
And like we
and
talked,
it's injected, let's be honest.
And we talked earlier about missing fish. Well, a fish, if you've watched some videos on it, they can suck in a soft plastic and kick it back out before you ever even know that they had it.
Yeah.
It can happen really, really quick that they reject it.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly what you watch is bass doing it. They've got a lot of good videos of that. But I'm sure that redfish and trout have that same thing.
Sure.
Once they have it in their mouth, any scent, any anything that's
they
on
can
it,
do it so quickly. Like,
they, yeah, or it's really good.
Yeah.
You know, for the scent, the attractant scents, and like gulp. I think flounder hold on to a gulp longer than a regular plastic.
Yeah, you know,
than a regular soft plastic.
That's what we use on them.
And I think that that's because, you know, once they grab it, it senses
it feels right.
It senses that it feels right and smells right, whatever, tastes right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they'll hold on to it a little longer, which gives you that extra tenth of a second to set the hook.
Sure, and you feel it better because especially a flounder bite.
Yeah. Same thing with trout.
So I'm a little more protective of what I'm putting on the baits from my hands and such than actual scent. Sunscreen, I never
horrible.
Do that. I'll put sunscreen on after, but not during.
I'll use the Sol, S-O-L.
Yeah.
It's all natural.
Mm-hmm.
It has no scent to it. It's the old white stuff that you put on your nose, all the surfers, oxide.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's made out of. It's an emulsified version of that.
Okay.
There are no chemicals in it of any kind.
That's pretty cool.
And so that's why I use Sol.
Yeah.
It doesn't get on anything. It doesn't burn your eyes. It doesn't tear up like the rubber on your sunglasses.
Oh, yeah. That'll happen.
You know, some sunscreens have so many chemicals in them, they'll eat that stuff up.
Man. All right. What do you got going on this week? You got some fishing coming up next week, I know.
Yep. For whatever reason, I didn't book anybody this week. Mm-hmm. Not really sure what's going on with that, but I'll go out there and poke around on my own and see what happens. And somebody may call during the week and want to go.
Well, the weather should be have a couple of good days in there.
Looks
somewhere.
Like it. Mm-hmm. Looks like it's going to be okay. Things are drying up enough around my place, I can finally get on my tractor and go
Thursday,
mow
you can
my
get
pasture.
That done. Thursday's looking pretty good.
I've been needing to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, good. Well, this is Bite Me.
One other little thing.
Oh, go for it. Go for it.
After last week, you know, I had my 5 mile polling incident that
talked
about
the boat ramp confession. Oh, I forgot about this. I wanted to get to this. Yeah.
So this guy emailed me. This man emailed me and said he had a similar incident, but he was in Baffin.
Oh, man.
Away from everybody. And he finally flagged down another boat. And that boat came over with some tools, and they took a trolling motor battery and were
Change
able to
it.
Start him off,
yeah.
You know, a trolling motor battery. Since then, he started looking into these little portable jump start batteries.
Right.
And I'd looked into them in the past, but they were all so dadgum heavy and they're bulky, and I didn't want to mess with them. He sent me a link to one. It's a NOCO Boost Plus, NOCO Boost Plus. It's 1,000 amps. It's a lithium battery. It weighs like 2 pounds, 2.5 pounds.
That's incredible.
It's not real big. I mean, it's really, really small. It doesn't look like it should do what they say it will, but it will start a V8 engine for up to 20 starts on one charge.
Man.
And it'll hold a charge for a year. So you plug it in, you charge it up. I'm going to carry it in the boat, and I didn't want to put another big battery in it.
Right.
Because it'd be just, you know, that much extra weight. And
right.
Like I said, on a polling skiff, the less weight, the better.
Especially for what you do.
Yeah. But having that, this little thing, and I spent a little extra money and got a little hard case for it that they make just for it. And
I'm looking at now, it's about $100, $98.
Yeah. With the case and all, I think I was at like $110 when I hit the checkout. I just ordered it right straight off Amazon. I'm supposed to have it tomorrow.
These things look pretty dang incredible.
Yeah.
And it's just for peace of mind.
Man.
When you pay $100 for peace of mind for a year.
Yeah. And then it's not like it's bad after a year.
Yeah.
It will just hold that charge for a year.
Sure.
You can plug it back in and charge it back up if you used it.
Right.
But having up to 20 starts at a time, heck, I'm going to have this thing in my truck.
Man, no kidding.
You just never know. Yeah.
Power goes out.
Well, and how often do you pull up at a convenience store and somebody's trying, you know, asking you to jump start them?
Here, I can use this.
You hate to pull up there and take your truck and raise the hood and jump start.
Or you can't get to them on a good angle.
You can't get to them, whatever. And this thing's in your truck. Mm-hmm. Just pop it out and you're the hero.
Yeah, that's pretty badass, right?
Same thing on the water, too. I mean, nobody carries jumper cables on the water.
No.
But I've seen a lot of boats that have been broken down with dead batteries.
Mm-hmm.
And I've helped out several of them where I've taken, you know, my trolling motor battery, like the guy that sent me this,
mm-hmm.
and moved it over to their boat so that they can start it up. It would be really handy just to have this.
Just to have anything like that. I mean, again, you know.
Case and all is under 3 pounds.
We always like to point this out because we're just telling you what we do and what we like. Nobody's paying us for this. We talk to you about things that we just like to use and do. That's a pretty good deal. Just for peace of mind, it's small, too.
I just ordered it this morning.
Yeah.
Like I said, I got it on Amazon Prime. Supposed to be here tomorrow.
Good deal.
And I'll feel better.
Yeah, no, like I said, just peace of mind.
Yeah.
All right, so Texas Saltwater Fishing Podcast. You guys have been great with us. You can reach us, as I mentioned earlier, via Facebook. We get a lot of messages. You can also reach me on Instagram, @LopezOnSports, Twitter, @LopezOnSports, Captain Scott Noel. On Instagram as well. You know it. The next best thing to being on the water is the Bite Me Podcast. You can subscribe today. Be a better fisherman tomorrow. Reach out to us, man. Whatever it is, we're going to tell you how we fish. I thought this show was fun because we gave you a couple of different perspectives from both of us. And so you can call through that. And hopefully you'll be able to catch a lot more fish. And when we talk again, you're going to have that big 7-pounder. We'll be able to talk about that all week next week. I hope you have a great weekend, and I hope you catch a lot of fish. This is the Bite Me Podcast for Captain Scott. I'm John Lopez. We'll talk to you next week.